Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 9th of November. We talk about the Penn State sexual abuse huge scandal this hour of the program with three guests with us. We'll have a staff writer for Grantland who grew up in the area and knew as a child all of the key players in this incident. Incidences. Later, we will speak with the executive director of the Support Center for Child Advocates, and still later, Jeffrey Rosen, professor of law at George Washington University, on legal responsibilities in reporting cases of child abuse. Our guest, the first part of the program, has written a very moving piece, which you can find online. His name is Michael Weinreb, and the piece is Growing Up Penn State. He writes, when he was five, his parents moved from suburban New York City to State College, Pennsylvania. They did this because his father took a job as a professor there. He assumed they did this because State College was considered a good place to raise children. A placid college town set in the geographic center of Pennsylvania. Those of us who grew up there like to say we live 3 hours from everywhere. They resided in a development called Park Forest on a street named after a British county. And the kids in the neighborhood played together in a little patch of grass right next to a house owned by Joe and Sue Paterno. And some of his little league coaches were people who have been mentioned in this scandal. He can say he can't add a lot to what's been written about the facts of the burgeoning scandal at Penn State, except to tell you how strange it feels to type the phrase burgeoning scandal at Penn State. He says he knows he is in denial. Michael is our first guest. He is a staff writer of Grantland, author of Bigger Than the Game, Bo Boz, the punky quarterback, and how the 80s created the modern athlete. He has contributed to ESPN, Sports Illustrated, The New York Times, and he is our guest the first part of this hour. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, for you to join the conversation. Hello, Michael. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
You wrote a very moving article, and I think that you said pretty honestly you're working right now. You're a sports guy and a writer, but you're working through yourself just as a human being, layers of anger and disgust and neurosis and angst. Yeah, did you hear me, Michael?
Sorry about that. I lost you for a second.
Oh, okay. What you're working through right now, just as a human being, because of your childhood in this community, anger, disgust, neurosis, and angst.
Yeah, it's all coming out. I mean, you know, I just found out 2 minutes ago before I came on with you that Paterno is retiring at the end of the year. And so that's, you know, even though sort of knew it was coming, it still stirs up a lot of emotions. I mean, things have been the same in State College since I was a kid, since before I was born. They've been the same, you know. Paterno's been there as the head coach since 1966. You don't find a lot of places where you have that sort of stasis, especially in sports. And so, you know, I mean, obviously, it goes without saying that the thoughts of the people who were victimized in this case come before anything else. But I think as a community, we really, you know, I think everybody in that community feels a little shocked and just, you know, that everything they thought they believed has been upended.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting you say the thoughts are with people who were victimized, and that should come before anything else. But it didn't come before anything else for years and years. Why?
I wish I could explain it. I mean, I want to hear what Coach Paterno has to say. I'd like to hear what some of the other principals in the case have to say. You know, there are a lot of questions that need to be answered. I'm very disappointed that the president of the university hasn't come out and said anything at this point. You know, it's been 3 or 4 days. He's the supposedly the lead, you know, person at the university, and he said nothing. And from what we've heard, he was the one who canceled Joe Paterno's press conference yesterday. So there are just so many questions that I have right now. You know, I'm trying to reserve as much judgment as I can, but obviously there is a sense that there were people who could have done more and didn't, and that is both sad and infuriating.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit more about Paterno and about Penn State. You grew up there. For those of us who are not big football followers, I've learned a lot about him in the last few days, but he has been held in such high esteem for such an incredibly long period of time. This must be pretty shocking to people who think of him as, you know, nothing other than a completely honest, wonderful, dedicated guy.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Penn State has always been associated with football, and football, you know, is Joe Paterno at this point. I mean, you know, you could make an argument that Joe Paterno is the most popular person in the state of Pennsylvania.
Oh my gosh!
The last couple decades.
Wow.
You know? So to hear, you know, and what set him apart was that he had this moral compass that, you know, people felt that a lot of other college football coaches and a lot of other college football programs didn't. When he first came in, a couple of years after he first came in, he declared something called the Grand Experiment, which was going to be, you know, this attempt to reconcile academics and big time athletics in a way that no one had before. And for 40 some years, with a few hiccups here and there, it seemed like it was working. And then to have this sort of egregious, what appears to be an egregious failure of judgment. That's why it's so shocking, is because people thought Penn State was different.
Mm-hmm.
And to get the sense that, you know, this is the place where maybe the worst scandal in the history of college sports pops up, it's just impossible to get your mind around it still.
Yeah, it really is. The enormity of this is just such a huge story. Paterno said, with the benefit of hindsight, I wish that I had done more. I'm sure a lot of people are saying that. But my mind keeps going to, was this not an issue 10 years ago that people thought was extremely important? Nobody thought of the victims of this or knew who they were or what happened to them. I mean, it's just unconscionable in so many ways how you can just turn a blind eye to this kind of sinful and felonious behavior and not really do something about it. From person to person to person, you call the police. Oh my gosh, I saw this horrible thing happen. I got to call the police. This guy needs to be arrested.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the first question that needs to be asked of everybody in the chain of command was, A, did you call the police? Which there's nothing in the grand jury report as far as we know about anybody calling the police. And if you didn't call the police, why did you not call the police? You know, what led you to do this? There's certainly this assumption that the preservation of Penn State football as sort of an unfailing institution was what led people to do this. I think that those are the questions that we need to ask going forward. If that is the case, then there's absolutely no excuse for it. And obviously, anybody who was involved with it needs to go and needs to be needs to pay the price, basically. But these are the questions that we need to ask over the coming days, I think, is why would that happen, or how could that happen, you know?
Right.
I mean, I think everybody who is associated with Penn State or has a emotional connection to Penn State feels that same thing that people outside the program do. It's just we're a lot more conflicted about it because it's much harder for us to believe that could actually happen.
Mm-hmm. Evidently, the Penn State students are holding a rally outside his house in support of Paterno right now. What do you think of that?
Well, they're kids. You know, at Penn State, there's a tradition to hold a rally for everything. You know, kids run out and celebrate in the street. You know, when Bin Laden died, there were thousands of kids running out and celebrating in the street. You know, I think, obviously, they don't want to believe that this is true either. You know, a lot of those kids probably came to Penn State or first became interested in Penn State because of Penn State football and because of Joe Paterno. I mean, his name is on the library there. You know, it's like you can't underestimate how much of an impact this guy has had, not just on football, but on the university itself. And so I think, you know, if you're a 19 or 20 year old kid who basically came to Penn State because of this guy, it's really hard for you to accept that he did anything wrong, you know. And you know, as more of the facts come out and as we learn more, you know, I think people will either have to come to accept that this is what happened, and just figure out a way to move on from it.
Mm. And Michael, you've written in your piece that this may mean that 30 years of your own memories of Penn State football are forever tarnished.
Yeah. I mean, it's weird. It's I don't know how I'll think about things from now on. You know, it's tough. It sounds really stupid to get this emotional over sports, but you know, it's more about the connection to your community.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the connection to your childhood, all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just it's going to take a while to, I think, for a lot of us to sort through all those emotions.
Well, your connection was profound. Your father teaching there, playing in the football field near Paterno's house. These connections run deep.
Yeah, I mean, my father still teaches there. And my father and mother still live there. And they'll probably be at the game this Saturday.
Hmm.
You know, so it's life will go on, but it's going to be different for a while. I don't know how long, but for a while it's going to be different.
How about you? Will you be at the game on Saturday?
I'm thinking about it. You know, I wasn't planning on it, but now that it looks like this is going to be the last home game, there is some sense that, you know, I don't know, maybe I should be there. You know, I live in New York City now, so I'm a few hours away, but
right.
But either way, you know, it's going to be a weirdly emotional moment. And, you know, I want to say again, I don't want any of this to overshadow what the victims
right.
are going through and went through. But it's a complicated situation for the community on a lesser level. But it is a complicated situation for them, too.
Well, I think you should go and write a lengthy magazine piece. You've got a perspective. No, you should. You've got a perspective that not many people have, Michael.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to get there at some point. I don't know if it's going to be this weekend, but I'm going to be there a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure over the next few months, just because I kind of feel like I have to be there. It feels like, you know, the only way a writer can get through something sometimes is just by writing their way through it. So it's kind of, it almost feels like one of those things,
right.
You know.
Right. Let's take a couple calls for you. Mike in South Milwaukee. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Kathleen, and good morning.
Good morning.
I call as a big college football fan. I'm a Badger fan. I've been to Penn State for football games. And I'm outraged by your guest's take on this. Here's the deal. In 1998, Jerry Sandusky was accused of abusing two boys. The police at Penn State investigated. In 1999, Jerry Sandusky retired. In 2002, an assistant football coach witnessed Jerry Sandusky raping a kid in the shower. Joe Paterno was told. Joe Paterno should be escorted from his office today. When he plays his last game this season in the Big Ten at Wisconsin, he's going to find out what the rest of the Big Ten thinks about him. This guy covered up for a rapist, and for the Penn State fans to feel sorry for him and to allow him to coach one more game is a travesty and an insult to all the rest of the Big Ten. That's my take on it.
Thank you, Mike, for your call. Michael?
I understand why people are emotional about this. And I, you know, everything he says, you know, I completely understand where he's coming from. It's a pretty, all I'm saying is it's a pretty deep connection between the community and Paterno. And, you know, and I think there's still a lot of shock about what happened. And I think, you know, I'd like to hear all the facts of what did happen. Obviously, the grand jury report is pretty damning if it is true.
Right.
Then Paterno does deserve a lot of blame for it. And I don't think anybody's absolving him from blame for it. All I'm trying to say is that there are complex emotions involved for those of us who have felt a connection to this program for a long time.
It's a say it ain't so kind
of
moment.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Kind of, yeah.
Well, before we let you go, I'm interested because you know football so well, and we've done some shows on, you know, the power of football and the money involved in football and the stadiums and the importance of the football coach and how much money comes to the university to other programs because of a good football team, et cetera. Is there an element to the story that points to, well, we're preserving football because of all the money that it brings to the university, and we can't have any scandal rock this program, so we've got to be quiet about it?
That's very possible. I mean, I think that's another question that needs to be asked. That's probably the element of the story that disturbs me the most, is that if they did this because they felt like it would reflect poorly on their football program, there's no excuse for that. And then there needs to be a much deeper discussion about, priorities at Penn State and priorities everywhere, probably.
Right.
You know, so that's something that we need to delve much deeper into if as the case moves forward that we find out that all this cover-up was as extensive as we think it was, and if it was because they felt like they needed to preserve the football program, then there's absolutely no excuse for that. And I think everybody at Penn State, everybody reasonable at Penn State feels the same way. You know?
Yeah. Michael, thank you so much. We'll look forward to more of your writing because you do have a unique perspective. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Michael Weinreb, staff writer, Grantland, author of Bigger Than the Game, Boz, The Punky Quarterback, and How the 80s Created the Modern Athlete. He's written, and I recommend that you go on the web and find it. It's a very moving piece. As a child who grew up at Penn State, his father teaches there still. His mother and father still live at Penn State, and he knows all of the people associated with this scandal. And it's hit him, as you can hear in his voice, like a ton of bricks. Michael Weinreb, Weinreb, is our guest the first part of the program. We continue this conversation, so we'll still be taking your phone calls. The executive director of the Support Center for Child Advocates will be joining us in just a moment. And later, Jeffrey Rosen, professor of law at George Washington University, legal affairs editor of the New Republic. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Frank Cervone is our guest now. Frank has a very interesting background. He's executive director of the Support Center for Child Advocates, the lawyer pro bono program for abused and neglected children in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. He has done direct representation to child clients in a variety of systemic reform, leadership, and community education services. He was a staff attorney at the Delaware County Legal Assistance Association, adjunct clinical professor at Villanova University School of Law, where he instructed law students in domestic abuse and child support litigation, and counsel for St. Gabriel's System, an agency providing treatment services for juvenile offenders. He's a graduate of the University of Pennsylvania and Villanova University School of Law. He has done all kinds of work in child welfare, and we are happy to have him with us for the next few moments on the show, and welcome phone calls as well. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655 for you to join our conversation. Frank, thank you very much for being with us.
It's good to be with you, Kathleen. Good morning.
Good morning. One of the things that's astounding to me is I've been looking at this dateline, key dates in the Penn State sex abuse case. We've got Jerry Sandusky founding this Second Mile, which is a perfect vehicle for him to abuse children, in 1977, and this abuse going on for years and years and years until it finally breaks so many years later. Something's wrong here. Something's fallen apart that he's allowed to continue this atrocious behavior for so long.
Yeah, you have to wonder, where was the community? Where were the institutions with whom he was working? Did anybody notice anything unusual about the kids and their behavior? I like to start by thinking about the kids. It's
yes, good.
You know, right, one has to recognize kids of all ages and all sorts of backgrounds find themselves in these sad situations, and that's, you know, one of the great sadnesses of our lives together. But the kids in the Second Mile program have really a kind of a special status. They're kids who were. Many of whom, as we understand, were away from their families. They had been removed because of issues of abuse or neglect, or maybe they were living up at the Second Mile program because of a truancy issue. The state government had been involved in their lives. They got removed. Real problem there. There's no one in their lives to act on their behalf. All of these kids probably had a lawyer, and I'm left wondering, where were their lawyers, and why didn't they have a relationship? This need for someone to trust, someone that a kid can turn to when something bad is happening, is something you can see and ask about really in every setting across the country.
Mm-hmm. I noticed that on several of these occasions, some of his victims were invited to go to some football games as his guest, along with Sandusky's wife. Is this an unusual kind of thing to give special favors to young person? And so if you haven't been given much in your life, you accept these kinds of favors, and it's hush money for sinful acts?
Yeah, there's a term in our work called grooming.
Grooming?
Perpetrators of abuse groom their victims.
Mm.
They solicit their affections before they act out on them.
Mm.
It's a seditious, you know, horrible way of being, but it really demonstrates the profound dysfunction in abusers of this sort. You know, you have the occasional abuser who did something. Strike somebody too hard, or maybe acts out the physical abuse incident. Occasionally, you even have kind of singular incidents of sex abuse, and those are serious enough. This fellow would appear to have been engaged in this practice for almost two decades. They have witnesses dating back, victims who have come forward dating back to the early 90s, and of course, you have to think that if it was happening then, and if it was happening to the eight young boys who are identified, that there are probably more victims out there.
Yes, we'll hear from more of them, I'm sure. And so tell me about Penn State, because that's the news here today. This guy is in the shower with some of these victims. People see him in the act in one case. And it's kind of this, report this, but we're not going to give it to the police. We're going to try and not deal with a child at all, and these are children, for heaven's sake. Figure out what happened to this child. We're not going to do any kind of big, you know, investigation and get rid of this guy. It's just incomprehensible to me that you wouldn't be absolutely outraged by the reports that you heard, and the football coach is saying, well, you know, I didn't hear all the details. Right, you didn't hear the details. I think you probably did hear what was going on in the shower. Why this guy wasn't gone, why this wasn't reported, this is a felony.
Yeah, so it really is hard, if not impossible, to wrap your brain around the events. One event, for folks who haven't studied the grand jury report, one event involves a 10-year-old boy. He's being sexually assaulted in a shower. He's naked. Sandusky's naked.
Gee.
And a coach, they call him a graduate student, still on the staff of the university, comes upon this, and he leaves. He doesn't intervene. He doesn't stop it. Horrible. Then he goes the next day and tells Coach Paterno, and there's, as you might imagine, some debate about how much detail he gave Paterno. But he was supposed to do that. He is, you know, apart from not having responded on the scene, this fella should have told his boss, and he appears to have done so. So then Paterno is supposed to tell his boss or make the report himself. Either of these guys, the coach or the head coach, could have made the report themselves. Every state, Pennsylvania is just like every state in the union, has a 24-hour hotline system. It's easy to make these calls. It's a system that's built to be protective with low thresholds so that we have a protective community. So Paterno tells his boss, the athletic director. And, of course, it would appear that the athletic director got more information than he's sharing. He's now charged with perjury for lying to the grand jury about what he knew. Right. So folks failed at every level of this organization. Very low level. Another of the incidents involves a couple of janitors new to their jobs, and they were said to have been afraid for their jobs. Penn State, like a lot of big universities, is a culture all its own, and of course the football team is everything to this university town, and so one has to believe that there was a culture of indifference, a culture of looking the other way, that these incidents just kind of got scooped up into the great morass.
Because you can't touch the football program. It's sacrosanct. It's too much a part of what the university is and how much money is brought in and the identity.
Yeah, I have to think emotionally. If you're living in that community, you're feeling so good about the program.
Right.
And it's such a, you know, a powerful organization. You know, it's not known to be a heavy-handed organization. The Penn State community in general is it's a civically minded community. They're legendary for their positive contributions to the needs of others, to poor people. They run a massive volunteer effort, one of the largest in the country, called the Thon, where they raise $1 million a year. They were probably opening the gymnasium and other facilities to kids in the community like this, and that's a noble gesture. So I don't want to paint this organization or the people there as somehow ogres or monsters. This is a community that is known throughout our state as one that cares about people. Even Paterno, you know, people are speaking very harshly about him today and about his failure to respond, and you know, one can't really understand why he didn't do more to follow up in these reports.
Right.
But he's genuinely, you know, Joe Citizen, very involved in charitable activities and the needs of young people. You know, in the end, it's why it all feels such a disconnect.
Yeah,
it doesn't add up.
It's a horrendous story. Professor Jeffrey Rosen is going to join us for a few moments, professor of law at George Washington University, legal affairs editor of the New Republic, to talk about legal obligations in a case like this. And then we'll be welcoming phone calls. Jeffrey Rosen, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
What are the legal obligations? And let's be specific about Penn State. What are the legal obligations that were not adhered to, if there were any, in reporting these incidents?
In Pennsylvania, as in many states, as Frank said, there is a legal obligation to report when you become aware of sexual misconduct. So the general rule is that a person who becomes aware of sexual misconduct has an obligation to report to their superiors, and people required to report include licensed physicians and nurses and school administrators. And then when the staff becomes aware of the report, then the person who is reported to assumes responsibility for reporting it to law enforcement. And you can be charged with a misdemeanor if you fail to report. So the two administrators who failed to report to the police are being charged under that provision. And many people are surprised to learn that the penalties for failure to report are quite mild. It's a summary offense, and it could be a fine of as little as $200 and a possible jail time of 3 months, but usually there's no jail time at all. So it really is not very severe penalties. The defense of the two administrators in this case is that they were not responsible for the students. The students were under the care of the Second Mile program and were not Penn State students, so their lawyer is saying that they weren't covered by the statute. It's quite disputable. If you read it, it's arguable that for all intents and purposes, Second Mile was administered by Penn State people and so forth. So it's not all clear that their defense will succeed, but they're hinging their defense on the idea that they were not covered by the statute.
Mm-hmm. And how long have we had this kind of law, Jeffrey?
Frank would know better than I, but I think they've been on the books for some time. And what is particularly striking, in addition to the mild penalties, is how seldom these laws are invoked and prosecuted. Once again, the lawyer for Mr. Curley says that he knows of no cases where people have been prosecuted under the failure to report law. And in October, for the first time, the Catholic Bishop of Kansas City was charged under a similar failure to report law for failing to inform law enforcement of child abuse in the Catholic Church. That was the first prosecution against a bishop in the church scandal, emphasizing once again how rare these prosecutions are.
Mm-hmm. Jeffrey, can you explain to me how it could possibly happen that more than one person could see an act taking place in a shower in the Penn State football area? I mean, see this felony behavior taking place, and nothing happens until years later. It's just really hard for me to understand that.
It is baffling on every level.
And right.
What's so surprising is either you have, as you've been discussing with Frank, people like the janitors who are afraid to report to their superiors, or in cases where a mother actually complains about
yes.
the misconduct
yes.
and insists on an investigation, and a police investigation takes place. First, the district attorney mysteriously decides not to prosecute, and then, although Mr. Curley, the administrator, was made aware of the investigation, he did nothing about it and waited until, that was in 1998, waited until 2002, and then didn't seem to connect the dots between the two allegations. So the law notwithstanding, as you suggest, it is absolutely baffling that this sort of repeated felonious behavior could continue without anyone
yeah.
stopping it.
Can you talk, Frank, about that case, too, that the mother brought forward?
Yeah, so she brings, the incident to the school authorities, and they dutifully report it. The local children and youth agency investigates and fails to respond. They don't find the case meritorious. And then the county agency, another set of investigators comes in and indicates the reports. That is, they find that there was substantial evidence that some child abuse had occurred. You know, I think there's one has to recognize, and I hope this doesn't feel to folks like the legal splitting of hairs. The perspective of years has now cast a more clarifying light on a bunch of incidents early on that should have been reported and should have been responded to. I'm thinking of these incidents in which Sandusky was found to be hugging inappropriately a boy. I have to imagine, not seeing any of the records, and we'll probably never get to know, that the first shower incidents, he came out and said, I was in the shower and I touched the boy on his back and I shouldn't have even have done that. So he minimizes it, and maybe the boy, likewise, when he was interviewed, somehow minimizes it. Many times in child sexual abuse cases, we don't get enough evidence because we haven't done the interview well enough, because the story isn't told well enough, or because the facts don't sufficiently kind of come together in a way that is compelling.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly now, in retrospect, we can see this whole pattern. It demonstrates, I think, Kevin, that the work is so hard. This work of intervention and protection is so very hard. Communities need collaborative approaches where they're sharing information so that all of the players who should know get the information.
Right.
And they need investigative tools that some communities have, what are called children's advocacy centers, or a place where kids get interviewed by forensic interviewers.
Mm-hmm.
The interview gets taped, and now 3 months later there's another incident, we can put it together.
Right. It's something is needed, that's for sure. Jeffrey, let me give this to you because I know you only have a few minutes with us. This is an email from Don in Fish Creek. Paterno should be fired immediately and divested of every penny of any and all retirement benefits and remaining salary obligations, travel, and or office perks. These funds, along with those of any other perpetrators, to be used exclusively for victims' compensation, obviously hoping to minimize his personal suffering and the focus of public ire on his role. An apology and announced retirement at the end of the year is further enabling and endorsement of the behavior behind the whole stinking affair and should be grounds for dismissing every school official that this is okay with.
Well, it's an understandable demand. There's such anger and people want accountability. It does raise the interesting question of whether there's a gap between what's illegal and what's fireable. Because after all, Paterno, in the judgment of prosecutors, didn't in fact violate Pennsylvania law. He technically fulfilled his reporting requirement by telling the athletic director and the administrative vice president about the conduct, and that's why he's not being charged with a crime. So is the fact that he's technically fulfilled his duties, should that spare him being fired? I think given the demand that the writer expresses for accountability, the trustees have already made clear that Paterno's tenure is over. Whether he should be shamed and fired or allowed to, you know, retire with some bit of face saving, I suppose, is up to the trustees. But it does remind us that the mere fact that he didn't break the law doesn't spare him for the need for some kind of accountability.
And what if there's a difference, Jeffrey? I've heard different reports on this between what he was told by the graduate assistant as to what took place in the shower and what Paterno told university officials. I've been hearing that he said that he didn't have all the details here, all the sexual details.
Yes, this is a very interesting part of the case. Paterno says that the graduate student didn't tell him about the details. And then, of course, Curley and Schultz, who summoned the graduate student several days, actually a week later, and asked for the details, say that they didn't get them either, that they only had the impression, like Paterno, that it was mere horsing around. Now, the grand jury did not find that credible. It concluded, based on the graduate student's testimony to the grand jury, that the graduate student had told both Paterno and Curley and Schultz about the graphic the sexual abuse that actually took place, so that's why Curley and Schultz are being indicted. But it's striking, isn't it, that at every stage the responsible officials claim that they weren't told the details, even though the graduate student said that he did tell them.
Well, this is an enormous story, of course, and I'm wondering what we as a society, we should have been learning things from the Catholic Church abuse horrors as well. Where do we take this? What do we need to learn from this legally, or just as good human beings, those who want to be good human beings and put an end to this?
Well, as you suggest, there's so many lessons to be learned ethically in terms of protecting children. But the most basic legal question I have is how is it possible that child abuse is harder to report and it's harder to protect children than even sexual harassment in the workplace? We have a appropriate series of procedures for reporting conduct in the workplace that makes people feel uncomfortable. Why is it that children, who are even more vulnerable, aren't protected by the same procedures? So I hope if anything good comes out of this, it will be at very least to beef up the penalties for failure to report, as well as creating incentives to stop this sort of stuff immediately. Because if we can't protect our children, for goodness sake, what good is the law for?
Yeah, Professor Rosen, thank you.
Thank you. Pleasure to talk.
Professor Jeffrey Rosen, professor of law at George Washington University, legal affairs editor of the New Republic. Frank Cervone is still with us, executive director of the Support Center for Child Advocates, and we're welcoming phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. Frank's program is for abused and neglected children in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. He has been providing for a number of years direct representation to child clients and a variety of systemic reform, leadership, and community education services. Let's go to more phone calls now. Our lines are pretty jammed here. Connor in Appleton, hi.
Hi, thanks for getting to me, and thank you. This is a fantastic program. I actually have had several questions answered already just on the legal side of things regarding Paterno. So I guess what I come to next then is in what other profession, are you not, in Joe Paterno's case, as essentially the administrator of the football program, in what, not just profession, but in what world are you not suspended indefinitely while such a serious investigation is underway? You know, and on the other hand, I'm sure that there was sort of a diluted sense of fraternal well-being, looking out for people who had been working together for decades. But at some point, somebody has to be able to remove themselves from the good old boys club, or however you want to phrase it, and recognize what's really happening. And it's just, it's appalling to me. This man is going to run out onto the, or, you know, hobble out onto the field, and just, I'm sure at home, be showered with applause, and it's going to be surreal. And I can't even begin to imagine what it would feel like for, you know, a direct victim of this scandal, or even any kind of victim of sexual abuse. It's just, it's mind-boggling to me that there isn't more outrage within Penn State itself, I guess, that, that Paterno is still holding his position as if nothing serious had happened.
Frank?
Well, I can tell you that on the local scene here in Pennsylvania, there's a lot of outrage. I think the community in State College and around the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania is pretty upset. I don't think there is, notwithstanding the pep rally that some students came out for him the other night, he's getting roughed up. I think it's obviously as well he should at one level. I do want to flag for folks the kind of back to the law, if we might. It was the standard in Pennsylvania back before 2007, and my reading of Wisconsin law is that it remains the standard today, that a person is required to report suspected abuse of a child whom they have personally seen. I'm reading the Pennsylvania, the Wisconsin statute, who has reasonable cause to suspect that a child seen by the person in the course of their professional duties, that's the trigger for the duty to report. And what's, you know, clear is that neither Paterno nor his superiors, the athletic director and vice president of the university, the kid didn't come before them in a professional capacity. In fact, they heard about it from their subordinate. Today, the Pennsylvania law has been changed. This was in response to the pre-scandal. In point of fact, a grand jury coming out of Philadelphia pointed out a weakness in our law that allowed, and folks get this scenario, allowed a pastor who hears about the alleged abuse of his subordinate priest, hears about it from the parents of a kid. And the parents come in, and of course they don't bring their child because they don't want their child to hear the story. The parents tell the pastor that that Father Joe did this, or that's what my child said. Because we had a seen by rule, the pastor came away believing that he was not a mandated reporter. And that is, in fact, the way it was taught. It's the way that's how the law was written. It was intended, I think, to eliminate kind of hearsay reports of abuse from the duty. In 2007, we got a new law here that said, if you're if your organization is caring for a child and you have reason to suspect that that kid's been abused, then you become a mandated reporter. So under that telling, in a sense, of the statute, that reading of a statute, all of these folks in the chain of command would have been legally responsible.
Yeah.
And I think Connor and so many others have pointed out the moral responsibility that he and that we all have to step
in. Absolutely. Thanks, Connor. Bill in River Falls. Hi.
Hi. I guess in listening to this, I would think this is a story about Joe Paterno and not Jerry Sandusky. When the assistant coach came to Joe Paterno instead of going to the police, well, shame on Joe Paterno for not going to the police. When Joe did the same thing and went up to his superiors and they lied to the authorities about it, well, shame on Joe Paterno because those people did that. And when the police were notified by this woman and the DA and they didn't do anything about it, well, shame on Joe Paterno because he didn't take care of this. And finally, when the media and the reporters who have been covering Penn State for the last 15 years didn't look into this, so-called journalists, not football coaches, but journalists, and missed this, well, shame on Joe Paterno. if you just put Joe Paterno's face on this, you're missing the boat because it's a systemic problem. And by just attaching it to one man, you're not going to fix a thing. Shame on everybody.
Yeah, I think that's fair, Bill. I think that's a reasoned and rational approach. We have to realize that the real bad actor here was Sandusky.
Oh, right.
And it is not just a legalism to conclude that both the grad student in this one particular incident, right, of the many, that the grad student and Paterno both did what the law required. They did much of what we all would require. Now, did they go far enough? That's obviously what the public debate is about.
Mm-hmm.
In our work, we often try to educate professionals and others about the duty to report. And it's remarkable how confused a lot of people are about the duty. It suggests that we need to do a better job as a child welfare community about teaching both the duty to report and how to spot the indicators of potential abuse.
Yeah. More phone calls in a moment. Our guest this last part of the show is Frank Cervone, Executive Director of the Support Center for Child Advocates. We are talking about the sex abuse scandal at Penn State this hour of the program. More phone calls in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to phone calls, Lynn in Eau Claire is next. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, Kathleen. I cannot tell you how deeply it saddens me that we call what happened to these children anything but rape. I'm a victim myself, and it minimizes what we went through and what we will go through for our entire lives, mostly from having been minimized, because child abuse is, you know, inappropriately swatting your kid. Rape is rape.
Yeah, Lynn, I certainly hear your pain and commend you both for being in touch with that experience and for the courage to share it. Several of the incidents described in the grand jury report are rape, even in the classic definition. But I think you make the good point that even the sexual touching, while it may not have in a sense amounted to or qualified as one of the rape or related offenses that we list in crimes codes, that these are assaultive deep into the person.
Mm.
It suggests, I think, an important message, Catherine, that for your listeners, if you've been victimized, if you have had this kind of experience in whatever manner and whatever time of your life, we urge you to tell someone and to get help.
Mm-hmm.
The worst thing you can do is to keep the secret. It keeps you from healing,
mm-hmm.
and it keeps, as we see in the Sandusky case, it keeps the perpetrator on the street.
Exactly.
And available to perpetrate again.
Exactly. Committing acts again and again, just off campus. Oh, man. Lynn, thank you very much for your call. Let's go to Bill in East Madison. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Part of my outrage, I guess, is that all this outrage coming from the public, it's as if, it seems to me, I'm 60 years old, I went to a Pac-10 university, you know, on the West Coast, and this was back in the 70s, when I was an undergraduate. There were two big scandals there, one of which involves a group of guys who happened to be on the football team who were committing serial rapes in the community. And another one was an attempted murder, a racially motivated attempted murder. But as far as they caught the serial rapists, discovered that there was three of them. They were all members of the varsity squad of a major Pac-10 school, right? And somehow, miraculously, all the charges got dropped. Everybody shut up. Everybody was paid off, and that was the end of that.
Frank.
Yeah. So what we see in child sexual abuse investigations is the cases fall apart for all sorts of reasons. So, I can't comment. I'm not sure that you can really know
thoroughly if in fact people were paid off as you suggested. But these cases are hard to make because, you know, in the main, you're asking somebody to share something very, sacred and traumatic that happened to them, and lots of victims just don't want to come forward.
Yeah.
The cases are hard to put together, and a lot depends on stringing events together and learning from them. If you were to read the grand jury report, of course, it's a shocking account of some very graphic details, but many of the incidents you can see taken on their own would be hard to make into a case for a crime.
Mm-hmm. Bill, thank you for the call. Frank, thank you. We need to have you back. You do so much important work in this old world. The world needs more people like you, I think.
Well, thank you. And, you know, there are wonderful advocates in Wisconsin, and there is an entire community of folks very dedicated to the care and protection of kids and their work with families. I hope your listeners are in touch with them. And, again, if it's happened to you or somebody that you love, try to make a difference in their lives by getting them some help, getting yourself some help.
Thank you, Frank. Frank Cervone, Executive Director of the Support Center for Child Advocates in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Thanks to Chrissy Pease and Rhonda Fanning for producing this important hour. Thanks to Chrissy as well for on-air production tomorrow during this hour. Chris Matthews on Jack Kennedy. Great conversations ahead.